Hello and welcome to The Special Ed Strategist. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, educational therapist, IEP coach, and your guide on this journey. Today, we are joined by a deeply caring, highly experienced developmental behavioral pediatrician, Dr. Mio Dovnik, who practices right here in the DMV area. In today's episode, we're going to shine a light on how medical insights can change everything from what's happening at the dinner table to what's written in the IEP or 504 plan. We're going to explore how to start noticing patterns, translate doctor notes into actionable school strategies, and confidently bridge that often felt gap between home and school. So whether you're just beginning this path or already advocating at every level, stay with us because you're not alone and you've got powerful insights ahead. So let's dive in. Hello and welcome, Dr. Mio Dovnik. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. So before we get started and really having this conversation about helping families bring that clarity with medical insights and how that's impacting their students in the school day, can you just take a couple minutes and introduce yourself and kind of how you got into your line of work?
Sure. So I'm a developmental behavioral pediatrician. Again, I know you've had those on the on your show, so maybe it's been explained before. But basically, we're pediatricians who have specialty training in developmental and behavioral issues with kids. So it's an extension of pediatrics with a more of a focus on those areas. So we are pediatricians, and then we do fellowship in developmental behavioral pediatrics, which is a board certified specialty in and of its own. I got into it in a very kind of roundabout way. I first trained in pediatrics and then did a short stint in the Navy as a military physician, a pediatrician actually in Japan. And then when I got back, I did some urgent care work in Los Angeles and then decided I needed to do some work in public health because I was doing a lot of global health work. So went to New York, Mount Sinai, did my public health degree, my master's in public health, and then realized, but I need more clinical background now that I have this experience in my area of research was toxic exposures and how they affect neurodevelopment in utero. And so then I was like, well, I need to know the kids that I'm talking about. So I went up to Boston, the Boston Children's, did a fellowship in the developmental behavioral pediatrics, but I was clearly further along than some of my colleagues because I was non-traditional route. And that's how I got into that specialty. And then I've been working in various settings, whether it's private practice, hospital-based. Most recently, I was working at Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore, and that was affiliated with Johns Hopkins. And now I'm actually in the Northern Virginia area, and I'm opening my own private practice.
Fantastic. So before I ask our questions that we're here to talk about today, I often ask my guest, what is one little known thing that you do that really doesn't align with who you are as a professional, whether that's a hobby or a sport or a club? What is something that you do for fun or relaxing?
Relaxing. Well, me and my family, we're very big into musical theater. We've all been in nice. Some ways, performers. We've, you know, whether it's my sister-in-law who's a veteran Broadway performer versus me and my wife who did it all through high school and college. And now my kids are getting into it. They're singing show tunes, and they're only 4 and 6. So it's kind of become a family pastime.
Yes, I think that is really fun. Our family sings, but we sing silly songs, not necessarily show tunes. So I'm sure you're more polished than we are when we're just belting out random stuff to be silly.
Well, when my 4-year-old starts singing Sondheim or my daughter can tell the difference between Andrew Lloyd Webber and a Stephen Schwartz musical, you know that they're starting to absorb your own fanatic ways.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. So we're going to circle it back here, really kind of setting the stage and trying to understand the connection between health and learning from your lens as a developmental pediatrician and thinking through as a special education lens and how that would impact a classroom to help support our families. So really, many parents may not realize how much medical conditions, whether it's a chronic illness, a sleep disturbance, anxiety, how that can really affect a kiddo's ability to be available for learning or to self-regulate. So from your perspective, what's the most important insight parents should really kind of understand about this connection?
I think it's important to underscore how connected they really are. They're almost dominoes, and if one of them is, starts to fall, they kind of all follow in the same fashion. So a child might have anxiety or chronic illness, and that disrupts sleep, and then poor sleep raises their stress. They become hyper arousal, and then they become emotionally reactive. They may lash out at parents, and then they may become anxious. And then the attention becomes harder to manage. So it becomes a cyclical, vicious cycle. And you really have to, you notice this in the classroom. The kids may act out, they may be distractible, maybe that defiance is maybe poor sleep in disguise. So we know sleep problems are strongly linked to memory, attention, mood, anxiety, and even aggression. And so when we think about school performance and how it affects learning, sleep isn't optional. It's an essential thing. There was a study actually just recently in JAMA that spoke about how 1 week of a reduced sleep by 40 minutes per night, just 1 week in kids 8 to 12, resulted in significant declines in their health-related quality of life. That included their physical well-being, their interactions with their peers, and their physical health. So I want to give you a chance to interject, but I think the key to breaking this cycle is actually starting with sleep hygiene. And before you address the attention and anxiety, you have to make sure the sleep isn't going to result in diminishing returns. I don't know how many times parents have told me he doesn't sleep, or he goes to sleep at midnight or after midnight. But let's address his attention first. And I say, well, we could try to address, the fire, but we're not going to put it out until we address the sleep issue, which is definitely exacerbating the attention and the learning problems. So, and then you give them, you explain what sleep hygiene is, and then you decide if anxiety is an additional driving, and additionally is driving the sleep disruption, because then you address the anxiety, whether it's relaxation techniques, CBT. You can break the cycle again at its root. So I tell parents, there's a two-pronged approach. You want to get better sleep first. Make sure you have a bedtime routine, the same bedtime every night, same wake-up time every night or every morning. The basics: dark room, quiet, comfortable temperature, all the basics. Then once the child's sleep is kind of in a routine, then you can see, well, okay, what's now the degree of inattention and anxiety? And then you address those issues next.
So when you think about kind of that the sleep component, how can you help guide parents that if it's, whether my kid does not fall asleep or my kid falls asleep and then wakes up or my kid, whatever that may look like, how do we kind of start to form that as a healthy habit?
It's really important to get to know the family, to get to know the child. I think that's where we kind of excel. The developmental behavioral pediatricians really try to get to know the family rather than focus on the problem. I try to get to know, well, what's going on in the family's life and the home environment that could be contributing to poor sleep, and also explain that some of these conditions, just by having the condition, there is poor sleep. It's a known co-occurring issue. So take ADHD. Kids often have sleep problems even before they start the medications for ADHD. They already have sleep issues. And take autism. Autism is known to have either difficulty staying asleep, nighttime awakenings. So each one requires a very specific approach to that child's issues. Is it sleep latency? Is it the time, how long it takes them to sleep? What is their pre-sleep routine? Are they on their screen right before? Did they miss their window to kind of calm down and unwind their brains? Or is their brain still racing? So each person, you can't just a one size fits all. You have to figure out the family dynamics, the home dynamics. Is the child sharing a bedroom with a sibling? Can they hear everything through the walls because everyone's still awake? There's a lot of factors that we consider that maybe are sometimes taken for granted.
With co-occurring, and I like how you said, to kind of get to that root cause, because oftentimes we do hear attention and anxiety and how to figure out kind of what came first or what is first. How do we go about that, kind of similar to what you're saying in terms of taking one component at a time?
Yeah, I mean, it's, and this is where kind of it's a puzzle. You have to figure out there's so much overlap between all these issues, the anxiety, the inattention, the learning, the social, the emotional. They're all basically in my head. I break it down into the individual components and I make almost a chart of, well, what needs to be addressed first and what can be addressed and then will lead to improvement in other areas because they're all so interconnected. And so I will focus if a child, for example, you take a child who has ADHD, who's a high achieving, say it's a 13-year-old girl who's a high achiever, straight A student, very motivated, may have some inattentive ADHD. What you may see first is anxiety. We don't think of that, but a high achieving, say, this particular female can compensate for a very long time for the inattention part, the distractibility, but the anxiety still builds up because they are working overtime. They're working, all pistons are firing. And so in the end of the day, they reach a point where they can't compensate for the increased demands, and then you start to see decompensation. And then it really comes forward in emotional reactivity, disruptive sleep, all these issues. And so you first have to identify, well, people may not see it for being an inattentive problem or distractibility until you actually ask the child themselves, tell me what happens in the classroom. What do you think prevents you from getting your work done? Why do you spend 6 hours on homework? Is that what the typical amount of time is? And this happens all the time. It really requires knowing what is causing. Is the anxiety a primary issue or is it a secondary issue? So that helps you decide, well, what do I have to address first? Do I have to address the ADHD or the ADD? And then that will alleviate the anxiety and in turn will help with sleep. And so again, everything relates to everything else downstream.
So as for a parent or as a parent that, is kind of new to all of this and sees the struggles at home and community and at school, when do you like them to come to you? Does the medical impacting the academic? Where is that conversation?
Yeah, I think the hardest part for parents is to know that there is somebody out there who deals with these issues. I think it's, when you don't know what you don't know, you can't really search for help. And so, I mean, oftentimes we're referring to psychology, where the child's first step was that they had a neuropsychological assessment. But for us, we often can pick up on certain conditions even without the neuropsychological testing, and we can do our own limited testing. And so I tell parents to, and again, it's complicated by the fact that it's hard to find and to get in to see a developmental pediatrician. It's one of the reasons I went into private practice because I want parents to be able to access my services, in a way that makes their lives easier. So I would tell parents, as soon as the child seems to be struggling with whatever it is causing social difficulties, emotional difficulties, if they're starting to get very frustrated and angry with themselves or lash out at their parents, it's time to see somebody to make sure we're not missing anything that is actually the root cause of all these behaviors. We see the behaviors, but we really need to trace them back to their root cause.
And there's even a lot of conversation right at the at an IEP table, you know, a special education team thinking of that from that perspective, just from an educational lens of what is the root cause of this behavior? And then working from there with that information. I also like that you had said, you know, what needs need to be addressed first. I say that to parents often of, all right, we have all these concerns, let's prioritize what we want to address first, but absolutely kind of going through and, you know, no kid wakes up in the morning wanting to be a jerk for the day. And so I think finding what that root cause is can be really empowering for a parent. And I think, though, as folks are listening to this, they're probably wondering, you know, when do I bring these concerns to a doctor, whether it's my pediatrician or now knowing about a developmental pediatrician, when should I have my kid tested or the school team? What kind of advice do you have for parents in that situation where they are seeing some things at home that are causing some unrest in their home with their baby, with their school age kiddo, but they're not sure who to turn to, or they're turning to somebody and that person is, you know, can say, oh, it's fine, or, you know, oh, it will get better, those kind of things. So at what point, how can we better direct our parents with resources?
I mean, I think I usually see the parent who's been to four or five other specialists before they realize that I exist, and which also speaks to the fact that a lot of other specialists don't know that we exist. We're kind of the hidden diamond in the rough here. The basically they should, again, there are reasons to do neuropsychological assessments. There's reasons to go to a therapist first. If it's anxiety, you would go to a therapist first if you can find a therapist. That's another challenge in and of itself, because where everyone says, you need CBT, but then finding somebody who provides CBT for your age range, for your specific concerns, is an odyssey in and of itself. So then I usually see the kids after they've been to four or five specialists who generally don't communicate, who generally give different advice. And then what I do is I take all of that. So I don't disregard anything that has been done, because I don't want to duplicate. And I also don't want to, I like to see other perspectives. And I take all that information and I make it, make sense. I kind of, instead of everyone looking at the elephant blindfolded, I kind of take off the blindfold and I say, okay, here we are looking at an elephant. Let's put the pieces together. What I would say, I mean, I don't want to say parents should finally come when they're not getting anywhere with who they've been seeing. I mean, I think we need to promote our what we do and do better marketing for developmental behavioral pediatrics. I just don't think also the hospitals make it a priority to highlight the services that we offer. And oftentimes, the hospitals have long wait lists anyway. So you may be told, well, this would be great for a developmental behavioral pediatrician, but then you're told you have a year and a half long wait. And you're like, well, I can't wait that long. So then you do go to see a neurologist or a psychiatrist or other specialties that have some overlap with what we do. But we also focus on kind of school. That's a big one for us. We focus on the school, the effects of all these conditions on social, emotional outcomes for the child. And we always try to make sure we don't neglect those, say, in an IEP goal. I find that academics are there, but you need the social emotional, because a child with ADHD has a lot of social and emotional concerns, and you need goals for those. So I don't know if that answers the question of when or they should come. They should come to us as soon as they feel they don't know who to turn to, but I don't know if that will m magically make us appear in their Google search. They should probably put in the Google search, still trying to figure out what a good, what the good search words, search terms would be. Because oftentimes I've tried this, I put developmental pediatrician, and you get a lot of, nowadays you'll get a lot of behavioral therapy centers come up. You get a lot of the big institutes, and so you don't really know it seems like, but they don't exist. So we're very humble. We don't self-promote, and that's our biggest Achilles heel.
You had mentioned CBT, and so for folks that are listening that may not know, that's cognitive behavioral therapy, just to put that into frame. And then you have talked about conditions. What are some kind of more common conditions that are coming to you that you're supporting?
So I see a lot of parents who want someone to just be there by their side for a child who has, say, autism, a young child who has autism, who may not have any current medical issues, but they really don't have anyone to turn to when they have questions about if a medical issue is coming up, when do I seek help? How do I help with this particular behavior or this particular they're not sleeping. I mean, we work through all of those things and we try to help parents resolve those issues before they have to go to a sleep center or a sleep specialist. I mean, there are things we can try, there are tricks up our sleeve that we will do to try to avoid, again, sending parents out to other specialists because they're already seeing so many specialist therapists. All the providers, the speech therapist, the occupational therapist, the behavioral therapist, the ABA, it's overwhelming. So to add me to the pot, I have to add value added. My value added is I can put it all together for them and tell them what should be the priority, what is, to try to simplify things. Let's take the top three things we really want to work on and focus on those now. Let's not try to fix everything all at once. And so, we're not going to fix everything today, but I'm going to be there. So a lot of parents don't have anyone who will follow up with them, who will check in a couple of weeks. Sometimes you do neuropsychological assessments and then it's kind of a once and done. And here's your report. If you have any questions, you can email us. But what I do is I take the reports, the neuropsych, and we interpret them for the parents. I know the neuropsychologists do this as well, but we kind of try to tie it in with the other issues that they're seeing medically, for example. And so autism, they want somebody to kind of have in their back pocket to reach out to. And that's something that I try to do. ADHD is clearly something that you need somebody to medication management. So even though a neuropsychologist diagnoses these things, or a neurologist may diagnose these things, sometimes they and sometimes pediatricians are comfortable managing to a certain degree. But then when three or four medication trials have failed, that's when they refer to us. And psychiatrists can handle this too, but again, it's about a broader focus. We don't, we do read the IEPs as we've learned to read these IEPs, these 40-page IEPs. It should be part of our training, but we actually learn it on the job. So we all have our methods of, finding out the salient information in these long documents that parents would never know where to look. I mean, it's just so much, and it seems like an archaic form of giving parents 50 pages of stuff that's difficult to interpret by an astrophysicist. So those are the kinds of things, helping them, guide them through the IEP process. They may need a medical necessity, support in pursuing certain accommodations. They may need, an official diagnosis of something, but the school can't do that. So these are things that we also can do, and we're very good at these particular tasks.
You and I do similar things in the sense of really helping parents through this process because at the end of the day, there's fear, there's love, it's your baby. You want them to grow, you want them to be successful in whatever manner that looks like, and really helping a parent pull all of this together because it is overwhelming and it's exhausting. And parents also are running a household and have jobs and didn't go to school for any of this, and and being able to understand an IEP or a neuropsych or your recommendations, and then being able to tie them together in a way that you can communicate to the school, I think is really powerful for our parents. And often having them do that in their parent input statement, and really looking at how students, looking at that or educational impact, not just the academics, and considering where the social emotional, from bell to bell, whether it's transitions or the lunchroom or specials or, outside on the playground or wherever that may be. And I think it's incredibly important for parents to have us as resources to help them filter through this information and prioritize, that educational impact based on our IDEA law, not just academics. But also you bring up, and I've said this a lot too, is just professionals tend to operate in a silo, and those silos don't tend to communicate. And I know that personally from my son, who was a brain cancer survivor, and there was a lot of just trying to figure out the balance as well, because the medical world and the school world look at things differently. And so really having somebody that can help filter that information is such a need and a priority for our families that are trying to navigate the school system with their kiddo.
Yeah, it's like you're planting the parent in a foreign city without a map or a smartphone in this case, and you're expecting them to find their way, and they really need, I mean, they need a guide. I think educational advocates are excellent guides, and oftentimes I'm recommending an educational advocate, and it's the first time they've heard of the term. So sometimes I'm introducing these, I don't know how many parents didn't know they could go through the child find process. It's, the school doesn't volunteer necessarily. I mean, some do, but I'm often educating them on that this is an okay process to go through. Don't, don't hesitate. It never hurts to have an evaluation in your pocket. You don't have to pursue the services. But it's good to, it's a start, and it helps us kind of get a sense of how they're thinking, how the child thinks and sees the world. I always wanted to develop an app, and maybe it's out there, and you can tell me if this exists, that makes it easy for parents to, like a HIPAA compliant Slack or something where everyone is, you can have them join, all your specialists join. And you can all communicate with each other instead of having to, and then the release of information is built in. So you automatically have everyone on your team, because I always talk about, this is Team Johnny, this is Team so and so. I'm on your team. Your parents are on your team, because parent involvement is key. Explaining this to parents that, a lot of it, they have to. They can't just say, well, here's my child. He's got some problems. Can you do something about it? You've got to say, well, a lot of it is going to have to take some structural changes in the home. And you have to gauge what the parents' capacity is to make huge changes. Are they ready to make changes? And so you have to really meet them where they are, both the child and the parent, because you're not going to convince a parent if they're not ready or open to these discussions. And so medication, I never bring up medication right away. I kind of lead to it in a motivational interviewing type of way. I kind of say, well, we've tried everything, and a lot of these things have helped, but we're still struggling with our social interactions at school. And Johnny is having a hard time making friends, and he's emotionally frustrated, and he feels isolated. And I don't want him to be to feel that way. So I take it away from just the attention and the academics and how he maybe he's doing fine with all the supports they give at home and all the supports he's getting at school, the pullouts. And but I say, yeah, but we also need to address these other issues that are part of the condition, because these conditions have so many different aspects to them. So just opening the mind, like blowing the mind of the parents, like, wow, I never even thought this was part of the initial problem. And then saying, yeah, it's all connected, and we're going to make a plan. And here's the top three things we're going to do first. And I often do this, because I know that a lot of times parents leave an appointment with a specialist and they leave that room and they're like, okay, what are we supposed to do? How is this helping Johnny in math? And so I make sure that they leave with, bullet points of these are the next steps. You're going to go send an email to the person at the school who, at your zone school, find, who the special educator coordinator is, request a child find evaluation. Okay. Then you're going to say, send me the copies of your latest neuropsych evaluation or speech therapy, speech language pathology report, because I want to read it. And then you're going to collect all the history. Say they've been on multiple medications and they're coming because nothing has worked. I want you to get a history of the medications so we know why each one didn't work, how long you were on them. And actually, that turns out to be a huge time saver for them. So every time they visit a different specialist, they don't have to keep recalling this information. So, and I tell them, I explain, there's an old school solution. It's a binder. I see some of the parents who already have them. So I'm like, binders really work. Three ring binders. Just whenever you get something, a report or a note from this, or an email or something that's relevant, put it in a binder. Bring the binder. They bring the binder to me. I know where to look, and I don't have to say, oh, do you have that note from the neurogeneticist? They're like, oh yeah, it's right here, and so I can read it. I can scan it in. So I try to give them practical tools because I know that I can say, go get CBT, go get ABA. And it's like, I don't know what that means. It's so abstract. And I try to make it very actionable because that I think is the biggest missing point in seeing a lot of different specialists. They don't, it's great, it sounds great, but they leave that room and they don't know what the first step to take is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And breaking it down. And again, that fear and that love and that overwhelm, having something that's actionable to go boop, boop, boop really helps guide us as parents. So, thinking that through in terms of taking all that medical information as a binder. So, what are key medical details that you think are most important for educators to know so that we can start kind of bridging that gap?
So I think, for educators, I think that what happens a lot of times is there's a misunderstanding between sometimes parents and educators about who's doing, who's at fault. Like it's pointing fingers. It's like, well, the school didn't do this, or well, the parents aren't doing this. And I think it's just a misunderstanding. And so a lot of times you try to kind of elucidate the different perspectives, say maybe the school has tried this, but it's not working. And even they kind of are at their limit of what they can do, or maybe they need you to ask in a specific way. Because what happens is parents get into battles with the school or the educators, and you want to untangle that battle so that so that everyone is on the same page and advocating for the child. So with educators, what I do is I will often tell parents that they can have the educator reach out to me, or if they want, I can reach out to them, so that we can kind of, because I get it. I can often read through the lines of, say a teacher report or a Vanderbilt or an IEP goals, or and I can talk to them directly about what I see, because then it's you're taking it away from this heated, you're not doing enough for my child, and you're explaining a little bit of, okay, here's some things you may not know that could definitely contribute, and I totally see where you're coming from. So you try to create an alliance. We call it a therapeutic alliance, where you're trying to work with the therapist instead of just saying, well, if the parent says that they're being stubborn, then they must be stubborn. There must be more to the story. And so I usually try to investigate and find what the rest of the story is. That's at least that's what I do.
Yeah, and I think it's important for parents to really think about one or two or maybe even three highlighted recommendations that are from medical reports. And again, prioritizing them so that they can really use those as a guide in the IEP for discussion to then really take the medical recommendations, thinking through again that educational impact so you can start to guide and form appropriate IEP supports or 504 accommodations for them. And a lot of parents don't even realize they can have you written into an IEP for professional and staff training. So I think that's incredibly important to know as well, that in especially our kiddos that do have more complexities around medical, that they can then you can come into a team and advise and guide and train them so that they can then ultimately better support the student that's in their classroom.
Yeah, you can explain how the medical condition plays into the areas of difficulty that they're having that may not be readily obvious, on the surface. And then you can explain, oh no, this is a known kind of secondary issue that we see in kids with this condition or illness. So you can clarify things. Again, my job is a lot of clarification. Once you clarify things, everyone starts to see things in a different light.
Yeah, absolutely. And even creating kind of that student health snapshot for a team, for a educator of this is who my kiddo is. There's their strengths, there's their needs. This is what really works well with them. Medications, whether it's a diagnosis, really to help everyone stay aligned. Are there other strategies that you've seen for sharing updates without overwhelming a school team?
It's, and I never know. And sometimes I think, I find that the teachers are very appreciative of being able to talk directly to me, because to have the family as kind of a intermediate sometimes obscures the nuances that I can get directly from the teacher or the special education coordinator and things that were left out of the history that I was provided with. And so I have this aha moment of, oh, now it makes sense. And then I can kind of bring it back in a discussion with the family in a way that's not viewed as being aggressive. We need a way to make things less overwhelming for the educators. They're basically they're inundated with these, medical letters of medical necessity that just lists a diagnosis, and that doesn't really tell you much about how does it manifest specifically in this child? Do they need every accommodation under the sun? Do they need a generic boilerplate list of, the 504 plan? Or can we be more specific? Can we say, well, so and so has a specific issue keeping a lot of directions or following multi-step directions. So that's one of the areas that we need to address. And so has trouble retaining information, when there's a lot of distractions. So it's not just, oh, okay, I need more time on to complete my tasks or extra time on tests. You make it a personalized approach. We're all talking about personalizing things, but really, if you just say ADHD needs a 504 plan or an IEP if it's affecting academics, or even then, I try to explain that, to meet the criteria for ADHD, for example, I mean for an IEP for ADHD, because usually ADHD they usually do the 504 plans unless there's clear other issues. But I explain, you also have to consider the amount of effort that's going into supporting this child at home. You can't dismiss how much the parents have completely restructured the child's life, how they're constantly sitting with them, how they're almost doing their homework for them sometimes, the clashes that they encounter. I mean, so what if the kid is getting passing grades? What is it taking to get to those passing grades? There's a lot under the surface. You're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. and you have and they have to consider that. If I took away all those supports from home and the tutors and everything else, where would this kid be? But I'm not going to let him sink. They're not, the parents aren't going to let them sink just to show that he needs help or she needs help. So, you know, it's kind of pointing out things that the parents may not know that they should be informing the school about. And again, teachers, they know all of this, but they may not be getting all the information. And so if there was a way, you know, I feel like it's important for teachers to be able to contact, you know, me. I just wish that that was something that was more readily attainable, you know, because teachers are very busy. They, you know, and we're very busy. And so when do we connect? And then keeping track of all the kids, we both follow a lot of kids. So you have to remember, you know, okay, these are the details. So we share a lot of in common, but I also respect their, you know, their expertise. And sometimes it's hard for me because I sometimes worry about certain learning issues. And I know that learning issues are more in the, you know, their wheelhouse. So I don't want to step on their toes. But if I'm worried about, say, a reading a difficulty issue early on, I might say something and say, can we do a screener? Can we do some additional testing to make sure that we're not missing a child who's able to compensate early, but will fall through the cracks when they reach fourth and fifth grade, because I'm trying to look into the future, and schools have a hard time because that's not what the, you know, special education is really. Well, we're going to help the kids who are already struggling, and I'm just trying to say, well, I want to prevent the child from struggling. I want to prevent the anxiety and the self-confidence that's going to decrease over the next couple of years. Otherwise, I'm going to end up with a kid in fifth grade who's never got an intervention, or they're just starting the intervention in fifth grade, you know, the horse is out of the barn, so to speak. And now I'm dealing with their self-image, their difficulties relating to their classmates, their feelings of you know, self-efficacy. I mean, there's so many things that could have been prevented. So sometimes I feel like, you know, I mention that, but from the way schools are structured, you know, they can't. Every kid that I suspect might have some issues they can't necessarily focus on because they're focusing on the kids who already have the issues, the full-blown issues. I don't know if that's something you see as well.
So I always encourage parents, back to kind of what you were saying, is to really consider the supports that you have in place, right? What are you doing for your student at home? Whether that is, you know, whatever that looks like, however much support that's being provided from a global standpoint, you know, under organizing their space and organizing their stuff, to waking them up every day, to, you know, some of that is appropriate and some we have to kind of start to scaffold to create that independence in a student. And so for our in a, and for an individual. And so for a parent, I always want them, if they're seeking an IEP, if they're going to a Child Find meeting, or if they actively have an IEP or a 504 and they're really wanting to be this active member, to come to the table of, this is what I'm doing at home. This is what reading looks like for my kiddo at home. Take a little video, take a little, you know, journal, you know, go old school pen and paper, or put it in your notes app or whatever that may look like. And also, if a student is medicated, let the team know, you know, this is what they produce medicated, this is what they produce unmedicated, so that everybody has a working knowledge of, again, that educational impact for a student from bell to bell, from the time they get off the bus to the time they go home on the bus and everything in between, and thinking of, you know, again, the social, emotional, physical, sensory, communication, cognition, process and memory, and really having all of that information so that you as a parent can start to be more of that investigator for your kiddo, so that you can be better informed for that advocacy, whether it's a conversation and talking to someone like you or other specialists or the team so that they're able to share this information in a way that really is clear and brings clarity to what they feel is taking place. And you're right, in terms of a lot of kiddos have those compensatory skills, and then they hit third grade or sixth grade or ninth grade and hit a wall of things are not working. So the more preventative we can do, obviously the better outcomes we're gonna see for our kiddos.
And also I also one other aspect is I make sure, I consider the parent factor too. The parent's overwhelmed. The parent has six other children. The parent is dealing with their own personal issues. Sometimes I see parents who are depressed. Sometimes I often see parents who may have executive dysfunction themselves. So you have to factor that into the home environment. When you're again, looking at the whole picture, and you have to kind of modify things with that in mind. How much can this parent handle right now? I should make it even simpler. I should just give one thing to get done in the next week. So again, you don't want to overwhelm a parent because then you're not going to get anywhere. Parents have to take care of themselves,
Exactly. And if you're, and if a parent's looking at, attention and irritability and emotional outbursts that can be misunderstood, and then trying to really figure out, where the underlying lagging skills may be, and then how is that related to medical conditions, and how is that related to the school, it does become very overwhelming for a parent. So, what is something that maybe we haven't touched upon that I should have asked? I didn't know enough to ask.
I think we covered a lot. I think that again, we touched on this before, but the certain conditions manifests differently at home and at school. And a lot of times I see parents reporting things that I don't see the school reporting, and then I have to broaden my differential on what could be going on. And I have to explain sometimes to parents that, well, the school is not seeing the issues. We need to figure out what's going on at home that could be possibly contributing to the behaviors you're seeing. Because I don't want to jump to a diagnosis if it's more of a parent-child dynamic issue. And so one of the things is, sometimes parents come in desperate to help reduce the defiance and oppositionality. And it takes work to figure out what the instigating factors are. And it's not always an underlying ADHD. It's not always an oppositional, they like to use oppositional defiant disorder. It's not. It's more ground roots. It's not something fancy. And you have to, and parents have to realize that that is a possibility. And I sometimes send parents, I explain to parents that right now I don't think medication is an option. I think these issues need to be resolved first. So I guess one of the things that I also do a lot of explaining about how we, I for example, I and I'm sure you do this too, is explain to parents how to use the IEP, not to get lost in the weeds of it, but to find the highlights, what they need to focus on, and the language that's used, it can be very difficult to decipher. And so you kind of explain that this is what it means when they say so and so will be able to write their name 4 to 5 times in 10 trials or something like that. You're explaining, well, they're working on this and they have certain measurable goals, and so a lot of it is, I think we make things a lot more complicated, and if we demystify things and explain them in really good ways, and I think that that's one of the things we try to do. We try to find analogies, we try to find little vignettes that we can use to describe kids. We try to normalize a lot of it, for the child's sake, because I don't like the child to start thinking there's a lot of pathology there. We try to explain that everyone has traits like this. It's not We call it ADHD, but that's more for, coding and billing. But really, we all have some ADHD. We all have autistic traits. We all have executive dysfunction issues. It's just a matter of degree, not of kind. And so that, I think, yeah, the take home for me is that at the end of the day, we're stacking diagnoses on this child, and we have to put into perspective this, these are just names and labels that are required for us to complete documentation. This is not a permanent mark on your future. And there are people who want to help you. This is actually me talking to the child. I'm on your team. I want to help you so that you can be the best that you are and do the best that you can. And you use an analogy like it's people need to wear glasses. You put on the glasses, you can see clearly. It's similar to that. But the person, happens to have bad vision or less than the 20/20 at least. So yeah, the one thing I find is we get caught up in diagnoses and forget that the child is taking this in. The child is not impartial spectator. They are absorbing information, and they can either become they can you can build doubt in themselves, or they can see it as, oh, well, now I don't have to work as hard. So you have to be careful in the message that's getting through to the child. And we tend to, I see this a lot in offices, throw these words around nonchalantly while the child is sitting there, seemingly not aware. They're aware. They hear these things,
They do.
and they start to wonder. And so I always finish by talking directly to the child and trying to say, a lot of people have these issues, and we're just trying to help you so that you don't have to struggle so much at school. That's basically what I try to do at the end of the day.
So, if you had one final tip for parents to put on a billboard, what would it be and why?
Wow. Depends on the tip that the child we're dealing with. I mean, I can give you an example of, also things evolve. We see transitions as kids get older. So always expect the behaviors, the issues that we're dealing with now are going to be different and manifest differently at different stages of the child's life. And some issues will go away, and some issues will present themselves differently. And you have to start to be able to, and as the child gets older, you have to start to factor in their personality, their social relationships. And so each stage of life has different a way of different presentation of the underlying issues. And it's not always going to be the same issues that they had when they were 3 and when they are 8 and then when they are 14. And just to, anticipate the changes over time and be wary that, oh, this is no longer an issue, but just make sure that it hasn't transferred to something else. The child with OCD now may have more, but no longer has the OCD, may now be somebody who has a lot of anxiety related to completing assignments and planning ahead. So, it's making sure that you're staying attuned to the different, to the progression of the child over time. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it absolutely makes sense. And really kind of following that evolution or the development of the students, of the kiddo, and looking at the environment and the individual and what works best, and really pulling you in and accessing your professionalism as a guide through this and the process of communicating and collaborating with other folks that are on that student's team.
Yeah, and again, things that we do that are different than other providers or specialists is I really, for example, I really want everyone to understand the child, the parents to understand why we're coming to this diagnosis. Why were you choosing to use this term to describe these symptoms? And the fact that sometimes it's expediency, sometimes we need a diagnosis. But you still have the symptoms, and these are the symptoms we're going to address. And so, again, explaining a lot of individuals need an explanation of what is autism. What is, not it's not just a list of things that they check off on an internet checklist. there's more to it. And again, if you want to inform and educate parents so they can be advocates for their child, always explain to them the special education process and that they have rights. And again, and explain what they can expect to see. A lot of parents come to me and they, with their 4-year-old, and they want to know, is my child going to go to college and get married? And I try to bring it back to let's focus on the now. Let's get through the next 6 months together. So not to jump too far ahead, because again, like I was saying about the transitions and evolution, you were saying things evolve, that we don't have a crystal ball. Kids are unpredictable. Kids are do amazing things. And so let's focus on the short term. And I think that's an important thing to take home, is to focus on the short term, not to get lost in well, what's going to happen 10 years from now? What's going to happen 15 years from now? Because 15 years from now, we're going to be living on Mars. So, no, just kidding. So we just don't know. So we need to focus on now and what we know.
What an excellent way to wrap up our conversation today. Dr.
Yeah.
Miodobnik, thank you so much for joining me, kind of walking through what you do and how you can better support families that need more of you. So I appreciate your time.
Sure, no problem. And again, if you can't find me, for example, because you're not going to find a developmental pediatrician if you just type developmental pediatrics. It just doesn't happen. Google does not favor us kindly. So you would have to look specifically for the name. In my case, a website. I don't know if I can give out
I'll
my
have
method.
that in the show notes. Yep, for
Okay.
everybody to find
So
you. Yeah,
just because I
absolutely.
want parents to have the option, I really do want the parents to have that option. And not be flustered by the time they get to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, such a pleasure, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. A heartfelt thanks to Dr. Miodivnik for translating clinical wisdom into real, usable tools for families. Parents, remember, you're the most powerful advocate for your kiddo they will ever have. And in today's conversation, it reminds us that listening deeply at home, knowing how to share these observations with the school team, and turning those medical findings into specific classroom-centered language aren't just nice to do, they're really, truly a fundamental. So here's your strategy tip that I would recommend. Start with using a one-page student health snapshot. Capture your kiddo's key diagnosis, any medication, greatest strengths in a brief, clear format. Keep it up to date. Share it with every provider, from the pediatrician to your child's teacher. It's a simple tool that's going to help build that clarity, the alignment, and confidence, whether you're in an IEP meeting or emailing requests for accommodations. So above all, trust that every step you take matters. By honoring both the medical and the emotional picture of your child, you're advocating not only for academic success, but for thriving for the whole kiddo. So until next time, I'm your host again, Wendy Taylor. Remember that in every challenge, you are your child's greatest hope. You've got this. If you found this helpful, please like, share, and follow. Until next time, bye for now.